Never thought I'd be saying these words, but our special guest tonight is actor, voice legend, and a Zen Buddhist priest, Peter Coyote. If you don't know him by name, you should. He's certainly been around long enough. I know you'd recognize him by face, but most importantly, you'll know who he is immediately when he starts talking. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Again, all of our bumpers tonight are featured in honor of the inductees into this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So may not be their most famous work. It may not be the song that you would have chosen, but all of them are connected to this year's inductees because it's quite a class, and I hope you enjoy them. It'll take me years to figure out why I got this honor of being able to talk to Peter Coyote. I'm really serious. Peter, thank you so much for giving us time on Coast to Coast. I've been a fan for a very long time, and I have to ask you, if you have a typical fan, people who come up and talk to you at restaurants or when you're making appearances as, you know, part of your function as a Zen Buddhist priest or promoting a movie, what would you say your typical fan is like?
Well, I can usually spot my fans because they're the ones hobbling up on walkers.
I am not yet, but that's interesting.
You know, it changes as you get older, Ian. I mean, when I was in the movies, you know, there's everybody has some addiction to having a conversation with a celebrity. I think it's because in the absence of true community, a celebrity is like a common denominator. Oh my God, I met Robert De Niro. He shook my hand. Oh my God, right. I met Peter Coyote. But it's kind of a thin soup. When I got out of the movies, it didn't take long for people to sort of forget. And then the people who come up are people who've either read my books or are interested in Zen, and they come up much more decorously and sensitively.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would be in that category. I'd probably say something really stupid and fawn. I'd probably go all fanboy on you. And I'll tell you why.
We've all done that.
Who have you done that to?
I've done it. I cringe at once having just murdered two meetings with people I completely admired, and I turned into a complete jerk and offended both of them.
How could you have done that? However could you have been offensive?
Well, I'll tell you how. And my son used to tell me, you know, Dad, I don't know how you do it, but you can say anything to anybody and they never get offended. And then I hit a certain age and I found out it wasn't true. And my girlfriend was the one who told me in no uncertain terms that a singer I met that I cherish above all, that I thought I was giving a compliment to, I was actually quite offensive to.
And, gosh.
You know, we do these things when we're uncertain.
Yeah, I think we do. You know, I am reminded of a time when my wife bumped into a particular senator, and she had liked this person, and she's much more into politics than I am, and she was complimenting his current commercial while he was running for re-election, and she said, I just really like the work that you did on that spot. I thought it had a lot of integrity. And then he said, well, it was the work of such and such, such and such ad agency. And she cannot explain to this day. She doesn't know why she said back to him, oh, like, you know them. It just came out of her mouth. And he looked at her like, shut. And she was so embarrassed. She had no idea why she said that to him. If it was such a diss, like, oh yeah, like, you know them. And she cannot figure out what happened. So I guess it does. Well, I hope I don't do that tonight. So promise me you'll give me a mulligan.
Ian, I'll tell you the best story like that. I know a friend of mine was in a Baskin Robbins in Westport, Connecticut.
Right.
And a woman was in there and Paul Newman walked in. And this woman made a great show of being unaffected by Paul Newman. And she ordered her ice cream cone and she paid for it. And then she was got her car keys. And then she was looking around for what she'd done with the cone. And she was looking on the counter and looking around. And Paul Newman finally leaned in and said, "It's in your purse."
That's awesome. That's, and the fact that it's Paul Newman is, it makes it even better. Well, I love that. And I just ask you then in advance for dispensation. If I say something really stupid, you'll forgive me one, and we'll get back to the conversation.
If I notice it.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I will tell you again why it is that I admire you so. And it's, I watch you on all these different levels in the way in which you have functioned in media, right? That it's just not, voice actors, one thing, you do such amazing reads, which I admire because I can't do them. And I also really love the parts you play, and yet there's so often you play the parts of the establishment. So whether it's in E.T. or whether it was Law and Order or whether it's Aaron Brockovich or other things, you're always the guy in the suit. You're kind of often the voice of reason, or perhaps maybe menacing, in the way in which you represent something about our culture or how something functions that seems nothing connected to who you really are and what you stand for.
Well, that's true. I mean, one of the things that amazes me is that all my friends think I'm really, really funny. And I started off in comedy, really, really funny in a comedic theater. And,
right.
I never get to play comedies. I mean, I'm always either the heavy or the brainy evil guy,
right.
Or
right.
The brainy nice guy. And, I think it's because I can make full sentences that are grammatically correct. I don't really know.
But you look good in the suit. You look like you have authority. You look responsible, damn it. That's what it looks like. You look like you're responsible for something.
So I have the perfect body for a suit. I wear a 42 long. And for about 2 years, I was the model for Nino Cerruti, who was the teacher of Armani. We were very good friends. He was my costumer in Bitter Moon, and we became great friends.
Oh, good.
And so he would make all the prototypes of his season's fashion in my size. And when the fashion show was over, he would say, "Well, go back and pick the ones you want." So for this I have probably a dozen fabulous old Cerruti suits. The buttons never fall off. They never shred. And, I look good in the suit. What can I say?
You do. And I think about scenes sometimes, like, again, we're talking with Peter Coyote. I think of the scene in Aaron Brockovich where you don't mean to be dismissive per se. I mean, you are doing what lawyers do, and yet what you're doing is, of course, being you're undermining her authority, the character and the real life person, and in the way in which you were kind of taking over, and you weren't doing it seemingly because you thought she was stupid. You were just doing it because it seemed absurd that this woman was going to continue on in the role that she had been, because now your character was called in and you were going to be the lead. And I think that's where I really like what you do as an actor, because you captured something which we all experience, and yet you didn't fall into any of the cliches. So when the character is challenging, when Julia Roberts' character is challenging you for control of the case, you seem really kind of confused, like authentically kind of like you didn't know what to say. And that's a hard thing, I think, to get to as an actor. Are you tracking with what I'm pointing out?
Yes, I am. It's actually something I've spent a lot of time teaching. It's called high status behavior.
Yeah.
And there are two, most people with strangers that they don't know too well will take one of two positions. They'll take high status, which is, "Don't screw with me, I bite." And
right.
It's signaled by control of the head and cutting people off, dismissing them, taking all the space you need in the subway, spreading your legs, spreading your arms. or right. low status behavior, which is like, don't screw with me, I'm harmless. And we've seen it a million times in every transaction. Every movie star is the highest status guy in the movie. And yet we're never allowed to recognize it. So I just played a high status guy who was used to being in charge. I'm a lawyer. I'm a pro. Who's the bimbo? Nice work. I'm here
right.
now. Go get a
exactly. coat. And it helps that you're 42 long because
yes,
the way.
Well, I was sitting down, man. Come on.
But when you fill a frame, I think that's really interesting, though, because you kind of loom a little bit. And there's a couple of actors, I think, of that in that way, in that space. And I think it is the way in which you, when you're, even if you're not playing the heavy, like I really liked you in that law, that limited Law and Order series. Did you enjoy doing that? Because it was part of the Law and Order universe, but it wasn't the most successful franchise.
Oh, you mean the one in Los Angeles?
Yeah, Trial by Jury or something?
We did about 8 episodes of
right.
Of L.A. Law in Los Angeles with Terrence Howard and
right.
Tony. I actually loved that show because it was full of moral ambiguity.
Right.
But it just didn't find an audience and, you know, happens all the time.
Well, that's surprising because of the success that Wolf has had with Law and Order, that there was ever a swing and a miss, because I thought it was a really good version of the Law and Order franchise. And I thought in particular, I love the moral ambiguity of it, because again, we live in moral ambiguity most of the time, which we're spending our lives trying to sort out.
Well, that's actually why my career has been better in Europe. I'm treated as a more important actor in Europe because they
that.
Like all the stuff that Americans can say, well, we don't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy.
Right.
The Europeans like that.
Yeah.
And both my fans in America do, but not so many others.
Well, you have to add a third one then and say 3, because I'm definitely in that category. You know, and I was not surprised when I read about your work. First of all, I love the cover of your first biography with the long hair and the mustache, because you look like you're in Three Dog Night. I just thought I'd tell you.
Well, I was living with the Hells Angels when that was made, and it was my first day I got my chopper on the road.
Shot.
So
oh, really?
I was a walking felony, yeah.
Now, the Hells Angels really were a criminal organization in many ways. Did you fall into that?
No, I mean, so there were... And back in the day, there was the San Francisco Hells Angels, which was pretty much a motorcycle club, and they were pretty party heavy.
Okay.
And the heavy duty guys who wanted to be, you know, drug dealers or
right.
all the strip clubs, they went to Oakland.
Oh,
and
really?
So the Hells Angels that were in San Francisco were out in the street with us, and they liked the Diggers, which was my gang. And I lived with this guy, Pete Nell, and we stayed friends for a long time. And I gave him that bike, actually, when we got evicted from the commune we were on. And we went on a road in a truck caravan of, like, you know, 9 trucks and 19 people. And I couldn't take the bike. So I gave it to Pete Nell. And, they asked me to prospect. I didn't want to be a Hells Angel. I had too many black friends. I had too many artist friends that were afraid when they came around.
Right.
But I liked them, and I had issues with violence that I had to work out. I grew up in a very violent home with a very dangerous guy, and I can see looking back on it that I had stuff that I had to get straight with.
That's interesting. What a way to do that. And we should mention the Diggers, because that's kind of the early... a formative way of understanding why you became what you became, but that may surprise people that, I mean, politics being whatever radical politics there were in the 60s, you were involved at a level that I think is just really admirable. You were involved in this whole free movement. So you were feeding people, and you were running a free store. And I don't know about the free bank, because that seemed like a disaster from the get, but...
But it was an interesting disaster.
Well, I don't know. How does a free bank work? Maybe
free
I didn't...
Bank works. So first of all, I got to tell people who the Diggers were.
Yeah, please do.
So the name came from a 17th century group in England when the Industrial Revolution was just starting and the king had made a whole bunch of woolen mills and he took away the common grazing grounds from people to graze his sheep on to get wool for his mills. And the Diggers were the first people to stand up against private property. And they refused to leave the grazing land. And the king sent Oliver Cromwell against them. And they were called the Diggers because every morning they were burying their dead. Mm. So at the time in the 1960s, much of the revolutionary patter and thinking was based on either communism or socialism. People were reading Mao. People were reading the Little Red Book. And we were artists. And we didn't want to be constrained and have to do plays about heroic bus drivers and heroic elevator operators. We wanted to live in a world that we could be authentic in. And so we decided we'd have to think it up, and then we'd make it real by acting it out. So it's important to understand that the free food and the free store and the free medical clinic were not done as charity. So we sent our women out to the greengrocers, to the farmer's market, and the Italian guys would give them food they couldn't sell that day. And we cooked it up, and we served it in Golden Gate Park. And we built a 6-foot by 6-foot yellow frame, and we called it the free frame of reference. Hmm. And all you had to do to get the food was step through the free frame of reference. And on the other side, we'd give you a little 1-inch by 1-inch attached to a shoelace, until you put it around your neck and start looking at the world through a free frame of reference. Hmm. And people might say, oh, well, no, I don't want to eat the food. I can afford to buy it. And we would say, wouldn't you like to live in a world with free food? So the reason that we did everything for free and we did everything anonymously was we figured that if you weren't trying to get famous and you weren't trying to get rich, you probably meant it. So the free store was full of, like, tools, televisions, bicycles, clothing, all repaired, all working in a really beautiful storefront. And the subtext of it was, why do you want to get a job to make the money to, why do you want to be an employee to make the money to be a consumer? We'll give you the stuff. Now what do you want to do? And so someone could come in and say, who's in charge here? We'd say, you are. And if you just sat there with your mouth open, there was no sense blaming the pigs or the man or the system. You'd been offered an opportunity to respond imaginatively, and you didn't do it. But you could say, oh, really, I'm in charge? Okay, and tell us how to reorganize the store, and we would do it. Hmm. So we had a lot of draft cards. We had all the codes to these draft cards. And guys would come in getting ready to ship out to Vietnam, and with a little decorous, subtle talking, Bobby from Chillicothe hang his uniform up in the free clothes rack and leave as Billy from Atlanta. So there was a whole kind of radical subtext to what we did. And then we brought doctors in Wednesday nights to the free store, medical students from University of California. And then this guy, David Smith, kept that going. It's still going today. So the Diggers was like a 3-year art project trying to imagine what the farthest out culture we could imagine was.
Well, I love the fact that already in those experiments, you were doing something which was transformative. And so you weren't looking necessarily for ideological adherence. You were looking for ideological incoherence. You were getting people to think differently, but differently didn't mean the same. And so that they were individually, yeah, they were thinking authentically, maybe for the first time in their lives. Well, I will say, let's stop right there and we'll pick up where we left off in just a minute. We're talking with actor Peter Coyote, who is also a Zen Buddhist priest. And I want to talk about that transformative work that he continues to do and how, in fact, it might also help you. And we'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. We're talking with Peter Coyote, and we're just getting into that idea of being transformative, because that speaks to his current work. And I think it's going to be very helpful for people who were calling in last night, for example, who are going through something alone and feeling like there's no hand reaching out to them from the other side to get them through to where they need to be. And they can't imagine the other side of the pain that they're experiencing right now. And they could use some help. And I think one of the things that Peter Coyote has been working on may be just the right strategy. We'll get to it next, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Talking with actor Peter Coyote. By the way, somebody sent me a tweet. I think you'd enjoy it. Said with regard to your role in E.T., a.k.a. Dave, said, ever since the first time I saw E.T. when I was 10 years old, I always felt that Peter Coyote's character, Keys, was actually Elliot's father. I thought,
That's that interesting. Been another movie.
Yeah, but an interesting twist, actually, when you think about it, because his father had been absent in the beginning, and if nothing else, kind of a spiritual father. Peter Coyote,
I did one of those UFO documentaries, a really good one called Out of the Blue, which was one of the first that had on the record interviews with naval pilots and jet fighter pilots and people like that.
That doesn't surprise me. Over 200 docs you've done the narration for?
Yeah, I'm restless.
No, but I loved, by the way, many people I think saw it. You brought the right tone. It was very well written too, in that series, The History of Sex.
Oh, that was fun.
Yeah. But it was really
the History Channel.
It was. And it was a little edgy for the History Channel. You kept it sort of anchored in something which I think kept it for some people from tripping off into something just being, you know, prurient or something, which I'm not saying is wrong, but in this case, it helped to really, the subject was treated with a great amount of respect, but there was also oftentimes a kind of a twinkle in your voice, like a little bit of that you're kind of sharing. You got the joke of what some of those awkward situations were that you were describing. And I thought that's again, just a tribute to just that kind of nuance that you bring to your narration. Certainly what you do with the Ken Burns series that you've been a part of for so much of your career. But I was going to say
anybody who's never laughed during sex has missed the whole part of it.
Yeah. Right. That's I think it was Woody Allen's line was, it's the most fun you can have in bed without laughing. But I like what you said better. But it's sort of a guiding principle. There's something in the Bible I've always thought of, and that's this one line from Psalms, which calls us all to make a joyful noise. That anytime we're making a joyful noise, that's just what God wants us to do. That's what the divine calls us to, is to be joyful. And I think that we live in a world where people become very self-conscious about joy, certainly about expressing it, and then worse, about expressing it in front of others. That somehow joy in any form is for some people just problematic. Do you track with that?
Well, I track with it. I'm not sure that that's been exactly my experience. Sometimes, sometimes I wonder why American culture is so obsessed with laughing and amusement and comedy clubs. And I can't help but think that it's and people are trying to antidote a lot of stuff that's going on that's not so pretty. I certainly love to laugh as much as anyone. But, I mean, you turn on the television, they're laughing while they're selling soap. They're laughing while they're selling vaginal deodorants. I mean, it's just like everything's fun. And that's not my experience of life. I mean, I have plenty of fun, but there's a lot of stuff you can do without being kind of having a foot in the small of your back and saying, enjoy yourself. It's the best of all worlds.
Well, I do feel like we're kind of saying the same thing, because I'm not saying that we walk around all the time and no matter what. I believe that there are times, you know, it's appropriate to be sad. And I think there are times when it's appropriate to be reflective and appropriate to never just be pursuing a kind of endless joy, but making a joyful noise and being willing to express it. I think part of what I've experienced, and this is some of the work I've done when I started in seminary as a chaplain intern in hospitals, is that people look back on their life and they just feel bad. And they sometimes miss both the joy that they had, but they also don't remember it well. And that's why I was really attracted to this thing that you were doing. And I wonder how much of it you do on a regular basis, but the book, Unmasking Your True Self, or The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha, and then you've got another subtitle, Masks, Meditation, and Improvised Play to Induce Liberated States. And that's the part I'm talking about, where people can find a way to get past the things which are holding them back,
sure,
if they're willing to play.
Well, I totally understand you now.
Yeah.
This book is really about something I developed, which is a kind of blending of my acting work and my Buddhist work.
Right.
One of my first acting experiences was playing a masked character in the San Francisco Mime Troupe. And when I put that mask on and I looked in the mirror, my personality was wiped out, and this character took me over, and I just couldn't make a mistake. I had no shyness. I had no second guessing. I had no self-consciousness, and I never got over it. And as I became deeper into Buddhist practice, I began teaching acting in the monastery to the children of the priests and stuff. And then those classes became really fun, and some of the priests began to join. And then one day I realized that there was something about these mask experiences, which I called enlightenment light, that I could give you, if I had half a morning to work you over and move you through different postures and different things that were not your normal behavior and stuff, when I put a mask on you and held a mirror up in front of it, you would take a vacation, cold sober. You'd have 5 or 10 minutes of absolute freedom. Yeah. And I would use that as a lost leader to say, so if you want to be able to recover that, you need to learn how to meditate, and you need to learn Buddhist description of reality. And we would talk about that. Well, and every student in the class would do that 3 times with 3 different masks. So one of the things about psychedelics, which I have nothing against, but psychedelics are kind of like flying to the Grand Canyon in a helicopter. You get there, it's awesome, it's mind-blowing, it changes your vistas, it does everything else, but you got there in a helicopter, and you can't get back without a helicopter.
Yeah.
If you get there by walking, which is either meditating or doing something like these mask exercises, you can get yourself back there, and that's the difference, because no one experience is going to change a lifetime of habits. It'll blow your mind. But if unless you practice staying and developing those characteristics that you learned, your habits are going to take over. And within a month, you know, you'll be the same old guy again.
Well, I love that. You know, and you did, if I remember reading somewhere about you, that you did experiment with some of the psychedelics in the 60s. More than some. What did you learn from those?
Well, so taking, you know, LSD and peyote and psilocybin and DMT and DPT and DET, they just sort of confirmed that my intuition about the way the world was, the interconnections between things, was pretty sound. I'd always felt that way about the world. I'd always had this sense that, you know, if you think about it for 5 minutes, you're on one side of the radio station, I'm on the other. But by the same token, neither of us have ever been separate from oxygen, from sunlight, from water, from microbes in the soil that feed our food, from pollinating insects, from birds controlling the pests. You can take it all the way out to the Earth's place in the solar system. If we were closer to the sun, water would burn off. We wouldn't be here. If we were farther away, it would freeze. And the Earth is held where it is by the entire gravitational field of the universe. So while we have this sense of self-awareness of this body, we're also like fleas on the body of a dog. We're part of one big thing. And I always felt that as a kid. I always had some intuition of it. And that was confirmed by psychedelics. But learning how to use it and learning how to control it, because you can't live in a fully enlightened space. We've got this body. We've got these limits of having a body and an individuated awareness. And you can visit, you know, Happy Land. And then the trick is you have to come back to the world and apply it and have to have the discipline to be able to control yourself and contain what comes up. So when you talk about people grieving and calling in, the Buddha had four things that he taught people. He called them four noble truths. So think about it a second. A truth means first and foremost real. And noble means first and foremost worthy of respect, worthy of dignity. So the first noble truth was dukkha. And the Buddha defined that as birth, death, illness, grieving, wanting to hold on to pleasant situations, wanting to push away unpleasant situations. And he pointed out that this happens to everybody. It's like pepper in the wind. It's not your fault. It's not evidence of spiritual lack of development if you suffer, if you're afflicted. It's what happens to all living people. The second noble, and so he says it's a noble truth, so you won't fault yourself for your inner experience. So the second noble truth is called samudaya, and it means arising. And so when you're afflicted, stuff arises in your mind, and you can't help it. The guy cuts you off in the car, you want to give him the finger. Somebody's rude to you in a restaurant, you want to answer him back.
Right.
It's not your fault. You get too hot near the fire, you move away. It's the third noble truth you can do something about. And that's called Nirodha. And what it means is containment. And the image that he taught was like a clay wall built around a fire pit. And any peasant in Nepal or India would have known what it's for. It's to contain the fire so it doesn't burn down the village. So affliction and what arises are like gasoline. And if you put gasoline in the form of an engine, it can do work. So the containment is what we do with that. And when we've got all those things rising in us and we meditate, we see that A, they may not be pleasant, but they're insubstantial. We can deal with them. Then the last noble truth is the Eightfold Path. And you turn that energy into a way of life that's dignified and helps people. Because most people are fleeing affliction and they're fleeing what arises. And you can meet them in the bars. You can see him having illicit affairs. You can see him compulsively gambling. You can see him compulsively shopping. You can see him questing for power because they've never learned to sit still and learn that you can contain this stuff that comes up. It's not going to blow you over.
Okay.
And that's basically what he taught. And all the rest of it is practice.
You know, there's just so many things you said in there that I want to go back over, but I feel like, for whatever reason, pointing out, I've never been high, I've never been drunk. I make a practice of prayer, but I wouldn't call it meditation. I rarely get to a state that I would call meditative, although I try. And there are times when I think I sustained something for a period of time where I really have, you know, sort of emptied my mind and found myself just in the moment. But I find myself all the time risking embarrassment in reaching out to other people that my wife, for example, has a hard time reconciling. She's, you don't know that person. Or she would say tonight, you know, well, I would feel like I made a friend in you tonight. And she would say, well, that's silly. You haven't met him. He doesn't know you. You don't know him. Don't call him a friend. And I think, well, I can't help but feel that, because just as you said, you know, we're breathing the same air and we're connected by the same spiritual tissue. So yeah, not meeting you is also kind of a technicality to me.
Also, I mean, in fairness to yourself, you went to a seminary.
Yep.
You've always had a spiritual instinct.
Yep.
Some people, I don't think everybody needs Buddhism. I honestly don't. I think it's a tough practice. It takes a lot of discipline. But I was going to die if I didn't find something like this. I mean, I used heroin for 10 years.
Really?
And when the 60s ended, I was a wreck. I was a single father. I had a daughter. A guy I knew had overdosed, and we'd been together. And if it had been me, my daughter would have wound up in the state.
Ugh.
I had to do something. And I had I had not such a lucky childhood. And so I needed to do that. But I know lots of people that got a good head start from their family. They were nourished. They didn't waste a lot of time running around in circles or have old neurotic things that they had to do. And I don't think those people need to practice Buddhism. I mean, I think their instincts usually lead them pretty well.
And that's a very interesting way of looking at it. My son is practicing Buddhist, and he enjoys kind of, I guess, I don't know how to speak for him, but almost a kind of roots Buddhism. He's really interested in going back to its early granular level. And he's less interested in kind of pop Buddhism, although he's gone to a couple of monasteries and spent time. I don't think he feels he's called to, you know, become a monk or anything like that. But that's like one of the few places I think where he finds people who are truly like-minded in their pursuit of peace that he is. And I find it beautiful, even if I don't understand always why.
How old is he?
28.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it sounds like, you know, he grew up in a home with at least a spiritual father. I don't know.
My wife too. Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's to me, it sounds like somebody who's got a good head start. He's not wasting his life in frivolousness. And he has an impulse to want to help people, and he has an impulse to want to live in a kind of orderly, dignified way. So, I think it's wonderful. The new book I'm working on is called Vernacular Buddhism and Vernacular Zen. And, you know, vernacular means everyday speech.
Right.
And one of the things that I've noticed over the years is that in a lot of Zen communities, which are very, very kind of imitative of the Japanese teachers maybe that they learned from, Those communities, there's been a lot of absorbed hierarchy and a lot of absorbed authoritarianism and not a lot of respect for feelings. People don't show feelings. It's like they're afraid of their feelings.
Right.
So every country that Buddhism came into, it wrapped itself in gift wrapping that made it appreciable to that culture. They could see it. It wouldn't offend them. They could understand it. So what I'm trying to do with this new book is loosen the gift wrapping so that Americans can see the real gift underneath, explained in non-Sanskrit, non-foreign terms for people who are never going to shave their heads or wear robes and who will understand that these are human states and conditions that the Buddha was talking about. They're not foreign. And I would like to see Zen begin to grow roots like the same way we sent our California roots to France to replace the grapes there when they were wiped out by a French bug.
Well, stand by with that thought because we're coming up on the top of the hour, and I want to get to those roots next with Peter Coyote on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.